Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug, ignored a leaky faucet, pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects, but there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few taps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects, and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Ophthalmologist Dr. Strauss has seen firsthand how the metaverse is helping surgeons practice the procedures to treat cataracts.
Cataracts are the primary cause of avoidable blindness.
He works with a virtual reality training platform developed by Fundamental VR and Orbis International to help surgeons develop the muscle memory they need. The result? More confident, capable surgeons. And even more importantly,
patients who can see.
Explore more stories like Dr. Strauss's at meta.com/metaverseimpact.
We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror.
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee. Alex, when we did the rapid reaction to the four teams being announced in the playoff field, sorry, Florida State, we did make the note that these were probably going to be two banger semifinal games, two, which we never have. We never have two good semifinal games. Among four teams that I think both of us thought each individually could win the whole dance. And so you have what is the best semifinal day we've ever had, right, Alex?
I think so. As a pair, because you're right that so few of the semifinals in general in the 10 years of this format have been good. Like the vast majority have just wound up not being very competitive. And you can think about how many different times a Notre Dame or an Oklahoma, or not just to pick on them, so many other teams have played in these games and just not had anything. A number of other programs have had games like this where they just haven't had anything. Everybody brought something to the table on this day, and both games were a blast. One of them is going to go down for me as one of the most memorable college football experiences that I've ever had. I'm guessing it's going to be the same for you. And the other was kind of a meandering, weird, almost drunken affair that turned really good in the last like 2 minutes ways that you couldn't draw.
So it was in New Orleans.
So it was in New Orleans. Yeah. I mean, it was if the French Quarter were a football game, it was this Sugar Bowl semifinal between Washington and Texas. So yeah, what a day. One of those days that kind of reminds you why this is fun. Do you want to start, Richard, with the Sugar or with the Rose?
Let's start with the Rose. We'll talk about the game itself, then we will talk about our just being there. We'll do that, and then we will talk about whatever that was for like 56 minutes, and then of the Sugar Bowl, and then whatever it was for the last four. All right, Alabama 27. Oh, Jesus, Michigan 27. Alabama 20 in overtime. Boy, okay. So like I said, we're going to talk about the experience after we talk about the game. The game, we do not have to pretend that a great ending makes a great game. That was not a great football game. That was a sloppy football game. That was Michigan winning without its A game, which is what champions do. That's what great teams do. They win without their best stuff. And you cannot take that away from them. I mean, Trevor Keegan literally told me in the locker room, he was like, yeah, we probably didn't deserve to win the game. Yeah, that's what happens when you muff two punts. And that's it. You muff two punts. You miss the extra point. I showed you the video because I was standing in the end zone where he muffed the one at the end. That was catastrophic, almost. It was almost a catastrophic play.
Michigan almost had something worse than trouble with the snap. I mean,
yes, that would have been worse than trouble with the snap.
Like, I was almost in hives watching that happen, just like the anxiety that I didn't even think I would feel for them. Could sort of see when he was going to field the punt that he didn't quite have it. And it was funny because I think this was their second punt returner who was back there because Samaj Morgan had his own muff problem at the beginning of the game. This was Jake Thaw back there. A nice recovery to prevent a touchback or, excuse me, a safety or a touchdown for Alabama, and then to get the game to overtime. The sloppiness for Michigan, I was pretty prepared, Richard, to make like my game story that I kind of wrote as my big takeaway when I was doing my freelance writing at Slate off this game. I was going to point out that in 2021, the 2021 season, they got overpowered by Georgia. In 2022, they got out-schemed, out-flanked by TCU, which just surprised them. And I was going to write, well, in 2023, they just blew it with a bunch of mental errors and bad special teams.
An extremely winnable game. They blew an extremely winnable game.
And it seemed like it was going that way. And then it didn't. With about 4 minutes and 45 seconds left in this game, Michigan like put on the big boy pants and just went to work and played, I guess, six or seven, if you count the overtime, of the best minutes of Michigan football that they've ever played as a program. And I wonder what you took away from that, the way that this game turned for them and what you think it turned on.
Well, I think the biggest... So let's do the whole thing. Let's go from the beginning. The beginning, I thought Michigan on defense was not physically overpowering Alabama's offensive line as much as they were just confusing Alabama's offensive line in pass protection. I mean, it's not like they're bringing six guys. Like, they're looping, they're twisting, they're stunting, and Alabama really did not have a ton of answers. Yes, some of it's on the offensive line. Some of it's a lack of awareness for Jalen Milroe. I'm just going to be honest with you. Some of it's like, dude, you're an empty, and they're three on two to your right or to your blind side. Like, you, like, ball's got to come out hot, brother. Like, that, it is what it is. So some of that, I was a little unimpressed with Jalen Milroe and Alabama's offense. I thought that at the end of the first half, they started going deep, in my opinion, to kind of like prove that they could. And I thought they were going to come back to it in the second half, and they didn't really come back to it in the second half. But what they did start to do in that second half is they started chipping away. They started getting Justice Haynes going. They started getting Jace McClellan going. They started getting that running game going. And then the bad snaps come on that one drive when it looked like they were about to go down there and score. The bad snaps happen, and that drive gets killed. I think the total was like four or five fumbles in totality by Jalen Milroe in the center, Seth McLaughlin, who they did not pull and don't pull, even though he's had these issues before. You know, I thought that Alabama's receiver core was, you know, as ordinary as we thought they were going to be. They did not make a splash in this game, really. I thought that Milroe, when he took the game by the scruff of the neck and he said, hey, I got to run this for a first down here, a first down there, he was able to effectively and able to give them what they needed. But he was the only thing that scared you on offense for Alabama in this game. Michigan on offense, I thought that McCarthy in the first half was not really all that good. I thought he was missing some gettable throws. You know, they had a really key third down drop that kind of comes to mind. Like, both of these offenses did not send their best. They just didn't. And I thought that on both of the defenses were executing, but like, I didn't think both of these defenses were like the 85 Bears. Like, I don't know. I come away from this game feeling it was pretty sloppily played on both ends, to be honest with you.
I would agree. I did think it was curious that after the big shot that you mentioned, kind of to maybe indicate that they could, that they really didn't at all go back to it. And I think they didn't hit like a true deep ball all game. They had the 29 yarder, I believe it was, to Isaiah Bond early. That was mostly a function of, decently a function of catching and running. They'll have to go back and look at that play. But there weren't a ton of just like deep shots, which was weird when you have a quarterback whose thing, other than that he can pull it down and run, is that he can throw it into the San Gabriels. And that wasn't what happened here. I think a lot of it was the Seth McLaughlin snapping issue. You know, I think we tend to think about the snapping issue anytime you see a snapping issue in terms of, like, you know, the ball's going to get away a little bit. You're going to lose yards. It's a drive killer. I think it killed Alabama in other ways too, which is that because of the thing that you were talking about how confused the offensive line seemed, how confused Jalen Milroe seemed at points, how the ball's got to come out hot. The ball can't come out hot if it's in your shoelaces. and you need to take the extra half second to get it up to your, to waist level so you can sidearm it out of there. But, you know, when a running back in the flat or somebody has a chance to catch it. And I think that these problems compounded for Alabama. There's never a good time to have a center who can't get the ball back to the quarterback, but this was like really not a good time because of the way that Michigan was causing problems with their pressures.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that Michigan, it, like I said, it is a testament that Michigan was able to win this game without their best stuff. I thought it was like, even when they get that Milroe fumble and you're like, oh, well, all right, like this is the opportunity here.
Yeah.
And they sort of let that opportunity go by the wayside. And I believe they missed a kick right there. And I was like, damn, like, you know, it seemed for the take. But I will say by the end of it, though, like, I didn't think that Alabama was going to win. You know what I mean? This did not have like this air of Alabama inevitability to it as you get kind of deeper in the second half. Yes, they did get rolling a little bit in the third quarter, but like, you just, yeah, I was talking to somebody, you know, on the way out when I got back to the hotel, and he was like, you know, it really kind of was a microcosm of Alabama's season. Like, they just, it was blood from stones to get to this point, right? We have talked ad nauseum. They are not the Alabama, the best Alabama team that we've seen, and yet they are here. Yes, committee, I know, Florida State fans, I know. But, you know, it they're not the best Alabama outfit we've seen, and still, they were in overtime with a chance to get away with it. He almost got away with it again.
He did almost get away with it again. To get this game to overtime, I think Michigan had to mount like a serious drive, the 75 yard drive that took you know, 2 drive. Minutes and whatever. And this and was the defining.
Even got by that penalty there, right? The quorum. And by the way, that was the key. I mean, if Alabama gets the ball back there, to be honest with you, I think the game's probably over. I think they are able.
It was game over. I mean, it was going to be game over. I mean, they were, yes, there was going to be either no time or less than a minute. It was a 4th and 2. Bama got confused. I mean, they clearly lost Blake Corum kind of in the wash. McCarthy sidecarred him. He was to his left, brought him to his right. And then no one covered him in the flat. I mean, you could see Nick's body language on the sideline. Nick was beside himself that this was allowed to happen, and became a 35 yard play that then became more like a 20 something yard play because of a needless block in the back that fortunately for Michigan didn't kill him.
The one thing I will give Michigan, particularly Sharon Moore as offensive play caller, is I think they knew that Alabama in the middle of that defense did not have the right stuff. I mean, you 32, who I think is a really smart linebacker, is pointing stuff out the whole way. But go back and look at, I think it was like the first touchdown. Like, they just kept losing guys in traffic. Like, they're like, Michigan's like running mesh and running crosses over the middle of the field. And Alabama's just losing receivers and losing running backs. And like you're saying on that fourth down play, like, you just lose Corum coming out of the backfield. Like, it just kept happening over the course of the game. And when Michigan got their big plays, that was really how they got them.
It was. And I think that to Michigan's credit, they, over the course of this game, started to realize or to have some self-belief that they could do it without what you would call the Mickey Mouse stuff, which sort of worked. You know, in the first half, there was that insane pass back flea flicker play.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Really one of the sickest things a quarterback has ever done. The J.J. McCarthy long ball that got caught. I think it was Roman Wilson down the field. Like, I mean, like, where he caught it kind of reversing and somehow got it away a dime right on his man going to the sideline. But, like, so, like, that worked. In the second half, they had a shot that was going to be, you know, probably a 20 or 30 yard game, maybe a touchdown, that didn't work because the flea flicker, the Corum's toss back was short. I think that as the game went on, and particularly in overtime, Michigan got to a point where they remembered who they were and said, like, fuck that. And we're just going to give the ball to our All American difference-making tailback when we can, and we're going to get Roman Wilson on crossers where we can, and we're going to play offense that way instead of trying to, you know, get Alabama with something incredibly deceptive, kind of boom or bust. And it worked. I mean, in overtime, it was 2 snaps, 2 Blake Corum carries, and he's in the end zone. And then you go and give the ball to your defense, and that worked out pretty well.
And, you know, the last play of the game is just – I get it. You know, Jermaine Burton goes down, which actually happened like right in front of me. Jermaine Burton goes down on the play before, and then you're in that fourth down situation, and that's what you got. You know, it's QB power. I think Nick Saban said after the game that was one of the 2-point plays that they liked, and they just didn't block it. Besides the snap, which wasn't great, like, they just didn't block it. I mean, Milroe ran straight into just like a brick wall of Michigan guys, and
dude,
that's all she wrote.
Go back and look at that play and look at what happens to J.C. Latham, the right tackle for Alabama, who's going to have his name. I mean, he's going to be shaking Roger Goodell's hand at a very early time on his draft night when that time comes. And he just gets thrown backwards, like chucked backwards directly into Milroe's path. I mean, Michigan came to play in this game defensively and whatever problems they had, by the way, like especially I think on the first Jace McClellan touchdown run where Mikey Sainristal had like probably the worst rep of his career, like Michigan's best player, maybe like a great defensive back, maybe the worst rep of his career. And that led to a touchdown. But like Michigan's
that happened,
front
that happened
had,
twice, integ- by the way.
Had integrity.
He,
yeah,
there
yeah,
was
Michigan's
a Milroe,
front had integrity though.
There was a Milroe run that Sainristal got kind of broke off on too, which happened as well. But yeah, I like, you know, you come away from it thinking Michigan won without its best stuff. And I think it, on one hand, it should really hearten Michigan fans, I think, because you were able to win sort of this ugly kind of sloppy thing. You just pulled it out or whatever. And you would think that now you've got which, by the way, the championship game is next Monday. So we're quick here with turnaround. But you think that in a game week turnaround, they can get some things corrected, and they can get this ready to go, because what they got coming next Monday, let's do the Sugar Bowl first before we talk impressions of the day, Alex, between the two of us, what they've got coming down the tracks here with Washington is serious business. Washington 37, Texas 31, and boy, did they need every single second, Washington. So we just, to be clear with the audience, we did not really see the first half of this game. We were stuck in traffic somewhere in Pasadena, California, on a bus going back to the hotel. But of what I did see of the game, most of the second half, Texas just didn't really have an answer. And that's what we expected, right? We expected Texas to just not have an answer for three dynamite wide receivers. We expected Washington to not be able to run the ball, which they just were not able to run the ball. And if Dylan Johnson is hurt with a capital H, it's something very serious that we're going to have to come back to when we get to the national championship game. We'll see. He got carted off the field at the end there as Washington celebrated on the field their Sugar Bowl victory. Adunze went for 125. Polk went for 122. McMillan had 58. Like they did pretty much exactly what you expected them to do, right? And then that defense, God, they bend and they bend and they bend, but they didn't break.
Yeah,
they didn't break.
No, they didn't break. There were a couple points in this game where I always come back to like, how can they keep getting away with it in terms of letting it get that close? There were a few of these, but they are opportunistic. The fumble on the Texas run down the field that wasn't called a fumble on the field, but where Raylan Goforth goes and gets it at the end of the defense kind of getting gashed. Washington doesn't have a great down to down defense. That was an example of this. Like, they just find the football when they need to. I think like the bendiest not breaking was at the very end of the game.
That's
when Quinn Ewers throws one up for A.D. Mitchell in the corner, and Elijah Jackson plays the fade the way that I believe cornerbacks and safeties are taught to play fades. It was pretty textbook. So I think that we need to be post skepticism of Washington's ability to do this kind of thing, because it's been 14 games. Like, they've just been against one of the hardest schedules in the country, and they just do it every single week. And by the way, they're going to go up against an offense that is, you know, we'll talk about the possibility of Michigan kind of bullying them up front if the offensive line is going to be in its most fine form for Michigan. But, you know, probably Michigan is not going to be more dangerous than Xavier Worthy and Jordan Whittington and A.D. Mitchell and friends were down the field, right? Like nobody thinks And I don't want to get too far ahead because we're still talking about this game. But you know, point is Washington's defense can hold. Like if they held against Texas, they can hold against Michigan. If your worry is, all right, in game 15, the top is finally going to get blown off these guys. If it was going to get blown off, it would have happened in this game or one of the two Oregon games, or pick your game, and it didn't. Or Washington State, which has a bunch of good receivers in Cam Ward, and it just hasn't happened.
I don't think you're worried about the – let's not do it. I don't think you're worried about the top – I think you're worried about Michigan grinding them into – okay, we'll get to it next week.
Could happen.
Yeah. I think that Quinn Ewers was bad in this game for like 2.5 quarters. I mean, from what I've seen, what I've gone back and looked at and checked back, like they just didn't have it in the passing game. I also am not entirely sure why it seemed like Byron Murphy and Tavondre Sweat just weren't playing in the second half, especially Sweat. I don't know if he got hurt or what happened there.
I was confused about Washington's entire – somewhat confused about their approach, even though it worked out. Washington never got away from giving the ball to Dylan Johnson. I mean, they like
it
they
did
work, not
but they kept doing
skip
it.
Like right. Like, they gave him the ball 21 times, and he did not get to 50 yards. He had 21 for 49. A long of 7 in this game and a couple of touchdowns when they were in short yardage. There were a couple of reps in the second half of this game in particular, though, where Texas just looked weirdly like non-involved. And I think that this was one of the plays where either Murphy or Sweat was not on the field, but it was a panics keeper where Washington had two linemen leading the way. One of them pulled, one of them kind of did like a little pin and pull. You know, basically two linemen kind of going up the center of the formation, and neither of them had to touch anybody. And they're both just like waiting for somebody to block. And that was, you know, like that's my theory that Texas was going to win this game, was that those two defensive tackles would give the Joe Moore winning offensive line something new to write home about in a bad way. And they kind of did. Like it's not like Washington established it at all. But Richard, you don't have to establish the run if your quarterback is throwing the football the way that Michael Penix Jr. was throwing the football. Like, he's just a special college football player. They don't make dudes like this.
My theory of the case was that Michael Penix is better than Quinn Ewers. And so if you give me Michael Penix and you give me 4 points, I figured Texas or Washington was going to win outright. I would say they did. He's just really good. He's just really good. There's no other way to say it. And you have seen the arc of the last decade-ish of college football be that elite offenses are just too elite to stop. Like, not just good offenses. I mean, when you've got the best offense in the country, like, you just can't stop them. And it has proved itself out time and time again in sort of the recent history of college football. Washington, until the last three drives, I pulled it up. Until the fourth quarter, Washington scored on almost every drive. They had one kneel down, but they scored on almost every drive. I mean, the way they put up points is just fantastic.
Also, Texas benefited in this game from a muff at the other end that kept this thing from getting into potential Laffer territory when Washington dominated the third quarter. The fact that Texas had basically grabbed a freebie touchdown earlier on, I think was worth noting in terms of thinking about how the control level that Washington exerted over this game. Richard, I think you were on the money that Jalen McMillan being healthy and playing as he's been in the back half of the year, like the very, very back half of the year, changes things a lot for Washington, like having more than just Adunze and Polk. In this game, their tight end, Jack Westover, was extremely involved. That is not always the case. I know you disagree with this because we talked about this at the time. I went on a very extended monologue about why I voted this way. Like, I thought that Rome Odunze should have won the Biletnikoff. I think he's the best college receiver in college football this year. No, I wouldn't draft him over Marvin Harrison Jr. I'm not nuts, but like, he is an insane player. And in this game, Penix threw at him 6 times. He caught all of them for $125. Also had, and now in the NFL spot foul here, it was only 15, but drew a downfield PI when they were going to put away the game.
That,
so they thought
that is a professional tactical foul, by the way, by Texas. Dude, defense had, back. Yes. That is how you draw it up.
Yeah, he had him. Rome Odunze had this poor Texas cornerback beat by, like, what would you say, 8 yards?
Cooked.
I mean, it was it, like, it was tough. Terrence Brooks is the young man's name. And that was tough for Terrence to be like, I would have acted like I was hurt if I got beaten that badly by a player. But that's the thing. Odunze just does this to people. And even if he doesn't, he wins the contested balls. I am going to be really interested to see, again, I'm going to put this aside, but just like how Michigan chooses to put their defensive backs against Washington's receivers and like what coverages Jesse Minter opts for in that game. To me, that's some football cinema. If you like the X's and O's a little bit, I think that that's going to be maybe the most interesting thing to sort through how Michigan tries to figure it out. Cause there's just too many of them. What's your level of concern for Washington if Dylan Johnson is absent, which seems very possible if you look at the way that he went down at the end of the game?
I don't know.
By the way, I had to Google who their backup running back was. I was like, do they even have another running back? They really don't. Like, they really do not have another running back. Their backup got like 30 carries this year. It's just like they are not a running back by committee situation by any stretch of the imagination. Bear that in mind. Big spot for whoever they decide to give the ball to next week.
Yeah. By the way, before we get off Washington's defense, I do want to note Texas did not run the ball very well. And I know that Texas was chasing a game here, but Texas did not run the ball very effectively. Again, I have not really seen the first half of this game. I'll go back and look and sort of take an assessment about how I think Michigan will do on this. But it is something to note, as we figured Washington up the middle was not as strong as it was coming off the edges, because they're not.
7.3 yards per carry if you strip out the sacks for Texas. That might be one where we have to check our priors based on not seeing the first half until we went back for it.
They were chunks. Like, they weren't, it wasn't a ground out. Like, Texas was not grinding this out.
Yeah.
Like, you've got a bunch of chunks.
Ewers had a big one. Yeah, Ewers had a big one, a 21-yard run. Both of their tailbacks had like 16-yard matching runs, and they both scored touchdowns. So, yeah, I mean, it was chunks. But the chunks count. And the chunks, like Blake Corum will take chunks. By the way, I think like Corum is a difference-making back in a way that like even Donovan Edwards is not. So that's another part of the game-planning matchup for Washington that probably is even more pressing, because you talk about like the fear not being that they'll have the top one off, but that they'll be kind of ground to dust. That too. I wonder if they might look at the way that TCU played Michigan last year and try to take some cues from that, given like the beef difference between those teams.
By the way,
Richard, we did not mention, we did not mention Braylon Trice for Washington, who is like really good and was causing significant problems for Texas in this game. I noticed Texas had DJ Campbell pull from the other side of the line to like pick him up as an edge on a sack that he had in the second half. It doesn't seem like you really want to do that. I think you should just have your tackle try to block him and give him some assistance.
I mean, it's a way to get into play action passing game. So I don't know. I'd have to look at the snap. At the end of the day here, for me, what I pull from this is part of that last drive. It was weird. That was a weird last drive. Like, Ewers comes out and they have the two throws to JT Sanders that he wasn't looking and go incomplete. Then they get down to like the 15-ish and they run that toss on first down. And you're like, dude, he gets stopped in bounds and the game would have probably been over. At the end, you only get one like catchable ball in the end zone, like in play ball in the end zone. And it was clunky. Yeah. There were like two timeouts. Like it was a very odd end of game drive that Washington just stands tall on at the very end.
And they only took, out of the four plays from the 12 or 13, two shots into the end zone at all. And like you say, one of them was like not a serious, by the time it was thrown, it was not a serious ball into the end zone. Sark is a really good offensive mind. I think everyone understands that. It was weird, especially with timeouts, with like the review timeout, for instance, after the throw to the sideline, where Blue made a really nice catch, by the way, to get Texas down inside the 20-yard line. It felt like there maybe could have been a little bit more there than in four plays, you got one shot in the end zone for a guy to make a catch on a fade.
Where are you at, by the way, on how Washington managed the preceding drive? Because remember, what, like, Texas gets that ball back with about 40 on the clock when it, I mean, if you just kneeled it out, it could have been like 10 or 15.
I had no issue with it. It's hard to predict that you're going to have a player get hurt on your team and stop the clock. It's unlikely on any given play that you're going to have one of your 11 guys get hurt and that the clock is going to stop in that way. Maybe it's a marginally bigger chance that that will happen than that something would go wrong if you punted it. Maybe you could have just run a play and been comfortable with where you were on the field. If you ran it down to 10, 15, 20 seconds, maybe you run a play and you don't care if you get the first down. But it's like, I did not see that as a Mario Cristobal situation. Like, a first down is of value to you there, of obvious value. And he's probably not going to fumble. And he's probably not, no one's probably going to get hurt. So I thought it was unfortunate for Washington and most importantly for Dylan Johnson that happens, that it saves Texas enough time to go down the field. But like, I don't have beef with a coach running the ball to try to get a first down that ends the game. Do you? Okay.
No, I am sort of either way on it, to be honest with you. Like, I'm not going to damn Kalen DeBoer for how they managed the end of the game. I was just curious because I know you're into clock management. Yeah. Just poking.
I am into clock management.
Godfrey's not here. Godfrey's not here, so we can talk about the Rose Bowl. How was your day?
Amazing. I mean, I think I've been clear enough on our show about my view of the Rose Bowl as a cool standalone thing in college football. I think that's valuable. I think we need as much of that as possible. And particularly in a postseason that has seen a lot of things get devalued, we need things that matter, that people aspire to, that they identify with special things. And, you know, yeah, like the Pop-Tart coming out of the toaster is funny. And I did laugh at that, but it's good to have games that don't need to rely on that and that can just rely on the scene, the history, what they are. So I like the Rose Bowl. I'm pro Rose Bowl, as we've talked about. I had never been there until you and I walked in the afternoon or even in the late morning to go and walk around before they even open the gates. It's awesome. I mean, it's great. Like, it's just an ideal place. Like, I think, like everybody says, or like many people say, not everybody, you get it when you walk into that place, why it is a special place to take in a football game. And I was blown away. Also, the Rose Bowl people definitely control the weather.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say that because I don't know their backgrounds. That could be a problem that I just said that. But
the weather.
Anyway, they called it a favor. They called it a favor.
Horrible all week here. Horrible. And then you got Chamber of Commerce weather for January 1st, both the parade and the game. The Rose Bowl, like, I mean, the stadium, the Rose Bowl, is interesting in that it is like the Cotton Bowl, where you can tell that just, like, everybody is focused on the game. Like, everybody is just, like, zeroed in on the game. Like, and I don't want to overstate this, but, like, you go to a lot of places, and it's, like, every stoppage is, like, kitschy Simba cam or Bongo cam. And, like, I get it. Like, you want to make it an entertaining, you know, game and for kids and all, I understand. But to old man yell at Cloud here, like, the Rose Bowl's about the game. Like, it's about the football. And, like, that place is packed, like, with 40 minutes on the clock before the game. Like, everybody is there. Everybody is happy to be there. And it is one of those places and one of those things where you do feel like for this 3.5 hours, like, this is all that matters. Like, the everything stops, everybody's keyed in here, and it's cool. It's cool to be in that environment. It's cool to be down on that field in overtime when it is just so intense. Like, it's like, dude, oh my God, it is so intense when you are on one of those fields in one of these spots, and it is single elimination football. Like, we're not worried about, like, Michigan's AP poll rank next week. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is like, if they don't get it, their season is over. Like, single elimination football is really good. I'm really excited for more of it next year.
It was so intense. I did not have a team in this fight. Like, I would be sleeping okay tonight if Alabama had won the Rose Bowl. my leg was shaking standing down there. You get to, they let the media go down there on the field in the last 5 minutes. I followed you like a puppy dog because you do more of these live events than me. Ran down there, correctly guessed which end zone they would put overtime in because of the way the wind was going. So I was able to stake out a nice spot down there in the corner. And it's just like the players who play this sport, like, are, I think that I sometimes, I don't think I forget it, but I think it's good to get reminders. They are incredible. And like the way that these guys thump and the way that they keep their composure with a circus around them at all times. Like, there's so many people on the field in close proximity to these guys while they're trying to work. Another thing about the Rose Bowl that I think really ratchets it up that is noticeable, there's not a lot of corporate seating, which has been a problem for them, by the way. Like, I think all these stadiums want more of it. But like, it's 95,000 people and 90,000 of them or so are like in bleachers, like in cheap seat, cold-ass bleachers that were put there in like 1922 or thereabouts. I know they've built it out a little bit since then. Like, so like, it's not a wine and cheese corporate crowd at these games. Like obviously it's a pricey ticket. Like, there's not a lot of people there who don't have money to get to this game, but it's not like everyone at the end of this game was so invested in it. And it was my first time covering a playoff game. It was my first time being, you know, right there at the end. And it was like emotional. It was just cool. And I think that part would have been cool even if it wasn't the Rose Bowl. So don't think I'm totally in the tank, but I was just thinking how lucky I am to get to do that. I mean, it was cool. And because of how much of the sport I cover just from my couch and from my desk that I'm sitting at right now and watching things on YouTube TV, multi-view or whatever, to get to go and stand in the middle of that was just really special. I mean, I'll never forget it. And it was cool to see the emotion afterward.
Yeah, man. It's when it's good, it being college football, when it's good, it's really, really good, man. And today in both of these games, it was really, really good. And it was really, really good to watch one of them, at least with you in person. So we move on. Semis over onto the national championship, Michigan and Washington for the Big Ten championship, the national championship.
Yeah. Well, great point. I hadn't thought about that. Good Lord. We will get into this a lot more for sure. I would leave you to start with this thought. I love the stylistic clash in a lot of different ways. Kalen DeBoer, you hear this guy talk, you see him on the field after the Sugar Bowl. It's like he's speaking to the librarian about where he can find a book on the shelf. Like, he's this very relaxed, always like almost comatose sounding, but that's not it, guy who is just like incredibly on an even keel and doesn't seem to really be too bothered about what's going on. And he's just kind of calmly leading Washington. Whereas Jim Harbaugh could ask you like what type of milk you want in your cereal, and you'd be like, huh? Like what? Like the way that he addresses people, the way that he kind of stares through your soul. So I love the personality difference between the coaches. I think that's a fun thing. I think the offensive identities being as different as they are is a cool thing. Like, Penix had to throw more wow balls in the second half in that game in general than Michigan has even asked JJ McCarthy to throw all year. And yet both teams are undefeated and they're going to be playing each other in this game. So,
undefeated champion, by the way. Yep, I know people undefeated are obsessed champion. With that.
So there's more than one way to bake a cake, and this game will exemplify that you can bake a cake in at least two different ways, maybe three, maybe four ways.
I don't really have a lean. I would tell you, if Alabama would have won just in overtime, if Alabama would have won that game the way that game played out just in overtime, if it had gone the other way, I would have taken whoever came out of the Sugar Bowl over them, like, pretty quickly. But I don't know. I don't have an early lean yet. I will take the next few days to evaluate how I think the national championship is going to go. I don't have an early, a knee-jerk pick.
Nor do I. My only knee-jerk reaction is that if you're a Michigan fan or if you're a Washington fan, we would love to see you on Saturday night. We're going to be in Houston. We're going to be at Rockefeller's, a tremendous, iconic concert venue in Houston, for Split Zone Duo Live, presented by our dear friends at Home Field Apparel. We've been saying it for weeks. It has shaped up. It is going to be our biggest show yet. We are just really excited to get down there. I haven't been to Houston since I was a kid. So to get back there, eat some good Texan barbecue, and also just experience what I'm told is one of the great cities in the American Southwest is really exciting for me. And we would love to meet you while we are there. If you are a subscriber to our Substack at splitzonedoer.com, then you can dig through the archives there and you will find a promo code, or you can email us for it if you can't find it. But at splitzoneduolive.com, get tickets for the show and have a great Saturday night to kind of celebrate the season, talk a little bit about the championship game, and most importantly, hang out, network, meet people who like college football in a similar way that you do. It'll be a blast. Thanks to our partners at Home Field Apparel for sponsoring this event.